Lecture 26, Descartes and the Skeptical Mind, the Authority of Reason.
There is a joke going around, it's probably gone around too often now, about Descartes going into a bar and having a drink, and when the bartender asks if he'd like another one, Descartes says, "I think not," and disappears. And this is a joke that's designed to convey the if not the philosophical subtlety, then the philosophical frivolity of Descartes doubting his own existence until he could come up with a good reason for it, namely, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. Well, there isn't very much that's frivolous in Descartes, and his philosophical power is a matter of record. In fact, on some accounts, at least in history of ideas and history of philosophy, it is with Descartes that the modern period of philosophy is said to begin. And as this is the 26th lecture in a series of 50, the modern period, we say, can begin with the second half. The modern period begins with lecture 26. And could it be entirely coincidental that it begins with Descartes? Well, I'll leave that to your own fertile imaginations. Speaking of fertile imaginations, Descartes was among the most fertile. He's the recognized founder of analytical geometry. He had made important contributions to optics and to physiology. He fought as a mercenary in European wars. He wanted to see service and do battle. He changed residences in France on a dozen occasions because his celebrity would not allow him to get work done. He was in frequent correspondence with the leading lights of the European intellectual and scientific community. Here's a force to be reckoned with. His dates are 1596 to 1650. He's alive, at least he's on Earth in 1600 when Bruno is burned at the stake. He's already a productive and busy scholar and scientist in 1633 when Galileo will be called before the Inquisition. So he lives in intellectually and politically and scientifically dynamic times, and he's very much at once the product and one of the sources of just these features of that great 17th century age of political and philosophical and scientific dynamism. Well, what about this cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am? It is said that Descartes was not a morning person in that he'd in these guest houses he'd stay in, he'd often be on his back in bed, sort of staring at the ceiling, conjuring all sorts of philosophical and mathematical possibilities, and when housekeepers and the like would be knocking on the door and asking what's going on and do you want breakfast and the like, the reply, I guess, would be, I'm thinking. I don't know how credible that claim might have sounded to the housekeepers. But if, in fact, he may have been the most productive chap on his back in all time, because we do know from the corpus of his work that he was a systematic and disciplined thinker. Well, of course, the one thing he wants to avoid, well, let's say the Scylla and Charybdis through which he wants to navigate that little philosophical skiff that will be his life's work, the Scylla and Charybdis will be the rank mysticism, superstition, magic, witchcraft, and the like that he already discovers in much of the Renaissance scientific writing and thought, that on the one hand, rank ignorance and superstition and dogma opposing his knowledge. And, of course, on the other hand, what he has to avoid is rank skepticism, according to which, given the corruptibility of the senses and the tendencies to self-deception and the very complexities of things, there isn't anything we can know for certain anyway. So Descartes, like Francis Bacon, is looking for a method. How do you find the right method that spares you from victimization by self-deception and superstition and also saves you from the melancholy state of the complete skeptic? Well, there are any number of candidate methods available. Descartes is a student of history and the history of ideas. He knows what's been tried before. And in fact, when he puts together his discourse on method, he makes it quite clear why he's finally going to come down on the side that he does. Look, you might say that the best way to find out about everything worth knowing is the study of history. And he has studied history. He says the problem with that sort of thing is he finds that that a man who spends too much time in a distant land becomes a stranger. The problem with the study of history is that it simply removes you from the very context in which the insistent demands for knowledge are indeed most insistent. History is a guide. History is not an answer. No two historical events are ever precisely the same. Anyway, what you get out of that kind of inquiry is a set of generalities eternally subject to interpretation, disagreement, and the like. What about vaunted philosophy? Could there be a better method? Well, of course, philosophy doesn't have a single method. And in any case, if you consult the great philosophers of history, the salient fact that emerges is that they scarcely agree with each other. So indeed, if philosophy were a reliable guide to truth, that argument, that long debate, would have been concluded a long time ago. What happens instead is every 15 minutes or 15 years or 15 centuries, somebody gets up and blows the trumpet, and what was received philosophical truth for a period of time is now false, and some other truth has come along. Descartes is satisfied that that's not going to do it. How about mathematics, the queen of the sciences? At least, and he is a great mathematician, at least there when you answer a question, you know you've got the answer, and it's true once and for all. The problem, of course, is that those answers are at a level of abstraction so removed from the facts of the physical world and our place in it that it's not entirely clear you really can match them up at all. So there isn't anything wrong with mathematics, but in a certain sense there also isn't anything really right about it as a method of inquiry, so to speak. Method of description, method of analysis, abstract method of representation, yes, yes, yes. Method of discovery, no, no, no. Well, what's the right method going to be? Well, he says, look, here's one thing. The right method should begin with an utterly skeptical position. The right method should begin with a profession of ignorance. Not only don't I know anything, but I am positioned in such a way that what I think I know is probably laden with error, misapprehension, confusion, and the like. So the right method starts with the assumption that I will accept nothing unless it can prevail on me as an idea of such power and clarity and logical weight and irrefutability that I am simply powerless not to accept it. So he's going to place the very highest standard of correctness on anything that could qualify as an item of knowledge. Anything that doesn't match up to that standard, he is prepared to reject. Wow. This is a very, very high standard, and it essentially rules out the objects of perception, do you see? Because nothing in that domain is ever going to satisfy a criterion of that sort. And in fact, there's a very good reason for ruling out the items in perception, and he gives us the reason. He gives it in the form of what I'd be inclined to call Descartes' worst-case analysis. I quote from Descartes himself. I suppose there exists an extremely powerful and malignant being directed toward deceiving me. Can I affirm that I possess any one of all those attributes of which I have lately spoken as belonging to the nature of body? That is, if there really is an evil demon or malignant being setting out to deceive me, well, now these things that I've talked about in relation to my own body, for example, he says, I've been talking about nutrition. I've been talking about walking. Here I am, walking around. Well, is there anything in any attributes of that sort, the attributes of materiality and material things, things accessible to the senses, is there anything in all those attributes of which I've lately been speaking that belong to the nature of body that wouldn't come into the purview of an evil demon setting out to deceive me? Clearly not. I could always be deceived about things like that. I might be dreaming that I'm walking instead of walking, do you see? I might be hallucinating. It might be a post-hypnotic suggestion. It might be some stuporous state that has me conjuring activities that indeed I'm not engaging in. It could be like something like phantom limb, where I've got an excruciating pain in an arm that isn't attached to my body. So things like that are just the province of a malignant demon setting out to deceive me. That's going to be a piece of cake for the demon setting out to deceive. He says, thinking is another attribute of the soul. And here I discover what properly belongs to myself. This alone is inseparable from me. I am, therefore, precisely speaking, only a thinking thing, that is, mind or reason. I am properly speaking, he says, that is, of what I can know, certainly. Properly speaking, I am a thinking thing. I am a res cogitans. I cannot say with emphatic and epistemic authority that I am an extended thing, a res extensa, because when it comes to things like I walk, I'm tall, my eyes are blue, these are things that clearly could be subject to self-deception or a deception promulgated by a malignant being setting out to deceive me. So it turns out then that the one thing I can count on as being so inseparably bound up with the reality of my being, cogito, I think, therefore I am. Because the only way I could be deceived is in my thought. First, you must grant that I am a thinking thing, even as a precondition for deceiving me. Do you see? I can't be deceived except as a thinking being. One might not ever be able to distinguish between reality and a dreamed reality. All empirical modes of verification are simply vulnerable to demonic deception, if demonically induced deceptions, if not self-deceptions. Nothing that is external to the mind can count against this demon theory. But to be deceived, the logical requirement is some sort of cognitive agent, do you see, to affirm someone capable of affirming or denying a proposition of the sort X exists, do you see. Thus, to be deceived, Descartes must be a res cogitans, a thinking thing, something with mind and reason. That's the point of the cogito ergo sum. The cogito ergo sum is not a device that Descartes needs in order to deduce his existence. It's not like he, of course, Thomas Reed playfully in the 18th century, referring to this argument, will say that a man who disbelieves his own existence is no more fit to be reasoned with than one who thinks he's made of glass. And that fortunately for Descartes and philosophy, Descartes was able to come up with a good argument that allowed him to accept his existence or his situation, and that of philosophy would be entirely deplorable. But in this, Reed is just kidding around, and Reed knows very well that what Descartes is seeking here is not evidence for his ontological standing. He's not looking for evidence as to whether or not he exists. He's looking for the necessary precondition even for skepticism to work, and the necessary precondition even for skepticism to work is thought. And so the one undeniable, even as the radical skeptic approaches us, daring us to claim we know anything, the one thing of which we have the clearest idea, the one thing that is inseparably joined to our very nature, and that in the act of denying would affirm itself, is thought. So it is the act of mind that constitutes the root ontological reality, that clear, undeniable, inseparable aspect of being that must defeat any complete skepticism. There cannot be a complete skepticism regarding knowledge, because the one thing I can know is that I am a thinking thing. Now, something very interesting comes out of this, other than the argument itself, and one thing interesting that comes out of this is Descartes got a method. How did he arrive at this? He didn't arrive at this by having the prescription of his glasses changed. He didn't arrive at this through some Baconian experimental lucifera and the like. He arrived at this through a form of rational analysis, a kind of axiomatic method, not unlike what one finds in mathematics and geometry and the like. And here very much we find the Descartes of the analytical geometry, the student of Euclid and the like. He is putting together a rational argument that leads to a conclusion capable of sustaining a particular position and defeating another one. That's the right method. You begin as the skeptic. You accept nothing except that which will prevail upon reason with such clarity and insistence that the denial of it is virtually a contradiction. That's the way you're supposed to go about your business. Every factual claim, every claim grounded in perception, is subject to distortion. Descartes' factual claim of himself as a really existing thinking thing can't be subject to deception, and that must be because the claim itself is not grounded in experience, but it is grounded in an airtight rational argument. Descartes, of course, is one of the textbook rationalists. Well, what is the method, then? I mean, we say that Descartes' discourse on method is one of the entrees into the world of modern philosophy. It's something that provides a dividing line between everything we take to be modern and philosophical inquiry and everything that came before it. Well, here are the four main points that are set forth in the discourse. First, as I say, accept nothing as true, except what presents itself with a clarity and vividness that is irresistible. Secondly, divide each problem into as many smaller steps as possible. That is, when you address the problem of knowledge, what is it I know, what can be known, how do I go about knowing, try to partition that into as many small steps as you can. And then, point number three, work from the solution of the smallest step up to the ever larger and larger and larger points in the problem, so that finally you reach the general solution. But you reach the general solution by working through solutions to the more rudimentary and elementary dimensions of the problem. And then finally, test the general solution with persistence. Go after it hammer and tong, assuring yourself that it's, as I mentioned in the previous lecture, here again, as with Bacon on the fruit-bearing kind of experiment, here Descartes is also anticipating a falsificationist criterion in the search for knowledge. What he says is, you test the general solution with persistence, assuring yourself that it suffers no exceptions. So what you're really looking for is the exception to the general rule. Any number of empirical confirmations won't be enough. Come up with the kind of test that would really show the weakness of this general solution when you find it. Well, there's Descartes on the discourse on method. He has deduced his own existence. He now has a rational method of procedure and the like. And so he can set out and engage in what turns out to be a rational appraisal of the traditional problems of philosophy, problem of knowledge, problem of ethical problems, and the like. Well, he turns his attention productively to, I mean, if it is the mind now, that is that mental activity, that root ontological fact that cannot be denied except in the process of affirming its existence. We must know something about mind. We must know something about the relationship between mind and body. The relationship, what kind of relationship can obtain between a res cogitans, a thinking thing, and a res extensa, an extended thing? This is a very vexing question. Some have argued that Descartes was the first to recognize the full import of this question. It is sometimes suggested in philosophy that the ancients had no idea that there really was a mind-body problem as such. Now, again, it's not within the purposes of this course to examine what the ancients may or may not have recognized. I think Aristotle and Plato were well aware of the difference between mind and body. I think Aristotle was deeply aware of the vexing nature of the question of just how the two become related. He does say that the faculty of epistemonikon, ukinetai, it doesn't move, which means that there's something about that basic rational power that doesn't seem to have one of the properties of matter. What makes a thing a material thing is that it is in principle changeable or movable. So when he says in his treatise on the soul that epistemonikon ukinetai, this rational faculty doesn't move, he does seem to be at least creating the grounds for an argument according to which there is an immaterial aspect of the mental, and that, if it doesn't solve a mind-body problem, at least offers evidence that the chap was aware of it. I'd always be hesitant about saying that some profoundly important problem in philosophy was utterly unanticipated in the entire history of classical philosophical thought. Nonetheless, in Descartes, it's central, and it's understood as the mind-body problem. The question is how an unextended thing can make an extended thing move. If you take Descartes as insisting that the mind is not an extended thing, but a thinking thing, that essentially what we are thinking things, which is to say, the mind not as an extended material object. Now, I'm going to show you, if that's true, then I will now provide evidence of an utterly immaterial, spaceless, massless, non-located entity causing a physical thing to move. Watch, I'm going to use a very sophisticated form of audiovisual aid in this lecture. Here we go. Now, the answer to the question, what is it that got my arm up at the level of folk psychology, is I wanted to raise my arm and I put my arm up. Now, what does it mean to say I wanted to raise my arm? Well, I had the idea that to illustrate a certain point for a class of students, it might be a good idea to show that volitionally I can bring about the movement of my arm, which is to say there was some sort of mental event that was then followed by a physical event, which means something mental made something physical happen. Sorry? Well, Descartes doesn't really know any way around this. He's fairly confident that the soul, the l'âme, soul, mind, is able to make the body move, but he certainly is not prepared to grant that something about the body can cause the mind to think, that it would be very, very odd if the movement of the arm then made me start thinking of problems in mathematics and the like. So we say that Descartes' solution to the mind-body problem is a limited interactionist solution in that he does see how the psychic dimension or the mental dimension of life can bring about physical effects, but he does not grant that the mere physics of the body can bring about events that are definitory of mental life. And what he's getting at here is this. Not that an injury to my arm cannot cause the psychological experience of pain. That's not definitory of the mental. Not that an empty stomach cannot create pangs of hunger as sensed and felt. No, he wants to take as definitory of the mental realm such things as abstract thought, what one finds in mathematics, what one finds in life. In fact, I think the best way of illustrating what Descartes does have in mind in declaring that a res extensa cannot determine a res cogitans is this. He raises the specific question. Could we create a device? He's great with equipment and devices and things like that. He would amuse himself in the royal gardens by stepping on one of those hidden panels covered over with grass, and sand would be released in certain ways, or fluids would be released, so the statues moved and engaged in little pirouettes and dances and the like. And he thought that this was a good model for the sensory motor dimensions of biological organisms, that this is how we, not to mention the entire animal economy, engage in movements. The external world stimulates the sense organs, sets up patterns of activity. Those patterns of activity are carried by some kind of spiritus or fluid medium through the nervous tubules. When the nervous tubules in the arm fill up here, the arm is pulled this way. If they fill up in the back of the arm is extended that way. And Descartes was satisfied that most of the sensory, all of the sensory, motor, emotional, appetitive, dimensions of life could be explained according to these hydraulic mechanical principles. He is one of the founders in the modern sense of a rigorously biological psychology. But he does draw the line when it comes to abstract mental life. And I say the best illustration of this is Descartes asks the question, could we make something that so closely approximates our humanity that you really couldn't tell it from an actual person? He's raising a question that today would be called the question of the strong artificial intelligence thesis. Could you actually put together some kind of device that would, you know, as we might say today, as we'll say in later lectures, pass the Turing test? He says such a device would always fail in the following ways. It may do lots of things very much like us. It would never attain the idea of God. It would not be able to host abstract conceptions, and it could not creatively use language. This is just another way of saying that the mark of our rationality, the mark of a thinking thing, is to be found in the creative discursive powers that a rational being has at the level of language. It's to be found in the rational power of abstract thought, particularly as it manifests itself in mathematics. And indeed, it is to be found in that ultimate degree of abstract thought in which we can contemplate the created universe as the outcome of transcendent powers beyond the reach even of reason, let alone sense. So Descartes famously solves the mind-body problem by granting that mind has an independent standing, that it causes physical events and is not caused by them, mind properly understood in those terms. Descartes is also the textbook character charged with hosting something called a theory of innate ideas. We are told that Descartes had a theory of innate ideas. People in Descartes' time chided him for his theory of innate ideas. Descartes went so far as to publish a document saying, "I have never proposed such an idea at all." And this is in the 17th century, and we are going to continue writing books criticizing Descartes for his theory of innate ideas. Well, in a manner of speaking, Descartes had a theory according to which some things that are obviously and universally known and could not possibly be known as a result of experience can only be counted, accounted for on the basis of there being some innate or intuitive or as it were, a priori, rational power or some bequest that the mind enjoys as a condition of being mind. Now, he illustrates this in a variety of ways. Shall I give you an example of what Descartes might be prepared to accept as a qualified, quote, innate idea, close quote, though he rejects the criticism that that has been heaped on him for having some sort of vulgar theory of innate ideas. Well, look, let's be really good empiricists about things, which Descartes wasn't, but let's be good empiricists about things and say this. Well, everything we know comes about as a result of the activity of the sense organs. The old scholastic bromide, nihil est in intellectu quod fuerit prius in sensu, nothing is in the mind which wasn't first in the senses. So anything that possibly can constitute an item of thought begins as a sensory experience. All right? Why don't we take that radical position? Descartes' sternest critics do take. Fine. The only thing we could possibly know then are our own experiences. Flashes and shapes and forms and sounds and tastes and touches and odors and the like. Now, if that's all we knew, if that is all that possibly could occupy the mind, namely these sensory experiences, there would be absolutely no basis, it would be impossible, it would be unthinkable for creatures thus equipped to reach the conclusion that in addition to sights and sounds and smells and touches, there is an external material world that is causally bringing these about. On what basis would you ever move from the experience to a conception of an external material reality causally antecedent to these experiences? The answer is you never could do that. You would simply be an experient. Every moment of life would be filled by things that are psychological, sensory, experiential, perceptual, do you see? At the level of idea. There isn't anything that would be hard, and there wouldn't be anything that would be sweet, and there wouldn't be anything that would be tall. There would just be this parade of perceptions. Everybody in the world understands that these experiences are the consequence of an external material world impinging on the organs of sense. Everybody knows that. Nobody is doubtful about an external material world. Descartes says, well, look, put these two things together. Everybody knows there's an external material world. The complete skeptic doesn't deny that. And you could never possibly have a concept of matter solely on the basis of experience. All you could have on the basis of experience are concepts of experiences. You'd have concepts about feeling certain things. Well, since matter qua matter is not something delivered by the senses, the only thing delivered by the senses are these psychic experiences, and since everybody knows that there is an external material world that is causally effective in bringing these perceptions about, well, then the idea of matter must be something immanent in thought itself. It isn't served up by experience. It must be one of the intuitive things that are available to us as percipients. And so now I think to some extent Descartes was being even coy here. He's going the materialist and the empiricist one better. He says, I'll grant a radically empiricistic theory of knowledge. If you grant a radically empiricistic theory of knowledge, there really isn't any basis upon which to come to the conclusion that the realm of experience is causally brought about by an independent external realm of matter, and yet everybody knows that that's the case. Well, I don't want to defend Descartes' conclusions here. I simply want to show that the new method begins as skepticism, uses reason and rational argument in a systematic way, and believes that the right approach to solving the problem of knowledge is that axiomatic, analytical approach characteristic of developments in mathematics and now being brought to bear more generally on the affairs of life and mind. The modern age is with us, warts and all.